Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode. It is time for the Friday Newscap, and on this last Friday of 2024, we'll take a look back at some of the biggest political stories of the year, from the state capitol to the U.S. capitol to the campaign trail. To do that, I sat down earlier with Chip Scutari of SNC Communications and former state lawmaker Jen Longden, and we started the conversation with the legislature and what broadly stood out about this year's session.
For me, I think it was the rancor, right? There seemed to be little opportunity for compromise overall. And like last year at this point in time, I thought I was going to be serving for this term. I dropped bills. I did have one third read vote. I did not expect to leave the legislature when I did, but, you know, it was a great opportunity for me. So I was pretty caught up in my new job through a good part of the legislature.
When you talk about rancor, mm-hmm. are you referring both to sort of the prevalence and the importance maybe of the ethics committees and also mm-hmm. the sort of the policy fights?
Thanks. You know, I thought I was over my PTSD and then you mentioned that.
Sorry.
Right, Chip?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was for me, it was, there seemed to be on both sides of the aisle a lot of inner caucus issues as well as a lack of bipartisanship. And sometimes it really felt like a lack of decorum. And decorum is so hugely important to keep things moving along. It's how you're able to disagree without, you know, literally beating each other up. And I found that disturbing and unsettling.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, remember the former House Speaker Tip O'Neill had that famous quote, all politics is local.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's been turned on its head that almost all politics now is national. So we have mm-hmm. these cultural fights and it's not localized issue, it's national issues. And I say that because of the abortion debate, you know, the 1864 right. law, I think that stood out to me because it kind of resonated with the regular public, not just political insiders who follow the Capitol day by day. And I agree with Jen that, you know, just the lack of civility. And another example of that is, you know, Governor Katie Hobbs trying to get her agency's directors confirmed.
Yeah.
Which when I was covering the Capitol, you know, back during the Nixon White House, you know,
not that, quite that long
yeah,
ago,
no, but it was pretty long ago. It was almost a done deal. If you were qualified and competent, you know, regardless of party, you would get confirmed. Mm-hmm. And I think that played out, and that was very rancorous debate, you know, went to the court where the governor actually lost the court case. Just you didn't see those things, you know, probably a decade ago, maybe even 5 years ago before this crew of lawmakers. And I think that the national contentiousness has spilled over into state capitals, not just in Arizona, but across all America.
Well, so you did cover the Napolitano administration mm-hmm. the last time that a Democrat was elected governor. And maybe you remember something different than I do. I don't remember her having really any trouble getting her agency directors confirmed.
No, none at all. I mean, there's a few who backed out at the last second. I won't say who, but there was never that they weren't going to be confirmed because they weren't qualified or competent. Governor Napolitano was a different type of leader, I would say, probably more in your face and not afraid of a fight or confrontation. And the other thing that was radically different back then is we had, you know, this word moderate. It's like a nasty, naughty word. Now we had
You're using air quotes.
There was a lot of moderate Republicans like Deb Gullett, Linda Binder from mm-hmm. Lake Havasu,
yeah.
And others that Sue Gerard that were totally different. They'd probably be Democrats nowadays. So it was just a different atmosphere and a different environment for politics at the Capitol.
And the procedure, you know, you used to go to the Committee of Reference,
yep.
CORE,
right.
for confirmation. That's where the hearing was held by the experts in that policy area. And now we have DINO, and it is, you know, it's all bread and circuses.
Jen, let me ask you, when you talk about the rancor, you know, the second year of Governor Hobbs' administration, she had fewer vetoes mm-hmm. than in her first year. But as Chip pointed out, there was the lawsuit about her agency director. She tried to get around some of that. I'm curious what you make of the relationship as it stands right now between Governor Hobbs and the Republicans who control the legislature.
Well, I'd like to see it settle down. I think in the first year, it was all about those opportunities to, you know, create division and, you know, throw red meat at the base. And I think in the second half of the term, folks settled down and got to the business of the people to some degree. And so that was helpful. I'm concerned about what it's going to look like again. We have a whole new host of legislators who didn't get their opportunity to, you know, take a shot at the governor last year. And so I think when you have a big influx of new legislators come in, and we've had a significant shift in the power dynamics in both bodies, I think those folks are going to want to, you know, it's going to be silly season for the entire first half of the term. They're going to, you know, try to make their own mark. And then I think next year they'll settle down to the business of the people. But in the meantime, you know, we Arizonans have to deal with ridiculous extremist bills and maneuvers and that sort of thing.
I think if we were sitting here 6 months ago, a lot of people were predicting that the Democrats would either take the state house or the Senate, and they're, you know, the Republicans did way better than anyone thought. So now they control that the state house and the state Senate. So if anything, they'll be emboldened to send more bills up to Governor Hobbs' desk, maybe just to get a veto out of it for social media purposes or for clickbait. But the one issue that they do have to handle or prepare for immediately is Proposition 123. Mm-hmm. Which is the education funding issue from state trust land. I believe they want to get it done by the end of January because the 10-year expiration date is May of 2025.
And it has to get reauthorized by the voters.
Yeah, so it has to go to a special election. So that's something that Governor Hobbs and Republicans and Democrats at the Capitol would have to tackle pretty quickly, or else that would be a real fiscal cliff for schools. So that's one thing that I don't think they can play politics with. They can, but it would be a big hit to our school and our kids.
Chip, where do you see Governor Hobbs right now? Because as you both pointed out, the legislature is more Republican now than it was. And Governor Hobbs put a lot of capital and a lot of money mm-hmm. into trying to elect more Democrats to flip one or both chambers, given that not only did she not do that, but Republicans actually did better than expected in the election this year. Where does that leave the governor?
You know, this is just my humble opinion, and she's not going to listen to me, but I'll offer it to the KJZ audience. I think she has to pick three or four key areas, education, water, elections, you know, healthcare, where she's going to lead, you know, where she's going to put forth a bold agenda, starting with the state of the state. And we talked about Governor Napolitano back in, when I was covering the Capitol. She was a Democratic governor with a Republican House and Senate. And she led with different topics, and she'd say, here's my red line in the sand. Here's what we're going to do. So I think mm-hmm. the governor has a golden opportunity to do that, you know, on affordable housing, on water, the ag to urban bill, the elections, having common sense solutions that we can speed up the counting process but not disenfranchise anyone. So there's a golden opportunity for her, but she has to make her mark right off the bat from the state of the state.
Jen, what do you think about that? I mean, where do you see Governor Hobbs politically right now, given that she's in the middle of her term and she just spent a lot of time, effort, and money to try to win the legislature and she didn't?
Yeah, I think that was a national issue all the way around. I don't think it's a particular weakness of this governor. And as Chip was talking, I was wondering, you know, I came in like the largest Democratic freshman class in a couple of decades, mm-hmm. just 6 years ago. And were we having these conversations about, you know, Governor Ducey midterm, you know, that has he lost power because we've shown up? I think Governor Hobbs has learned a lot in, you know, the first half of this first term. I'm looking forward to her second term. And I think she's ready to play.
Yeah, and also the backdrop to this, as we all know, it's going to be 2025. It's a year before the statewide elections. Mm-hmm. There's already Republican candidates out there, you know, kind of getting their teams together and getting ready to launch. So everything she does at the Capitol, meaning Governor Hobbs, will be under a microscope, and this is leading up to the 2026 reelection campaign.
So, Jen, Chip mentioned a couple of the issues that Governor Hobbs could potentially lead on, and many of them were issues that the legislature dealt with this year as well in terms of housing and water and education. Was there one or maybe even two issues that really stood out to you this year as ones that kind of, in your mind, dominated discussion at the Capitol?
Well, I think dealing with the territorial ban on abortion certainly took up a lot of oxygen in the legislature this term. And that was important. But substantively, I think housing was probably one of the big issues. You know, I think that they really took a good swing at some things. No one got exactly what they want. You know, they passed a couple of bills that will work to increase inventory, require cities of a certain size to amend their building codes so that you can put ADUs, accessory dwelling units, casitas, mother-in-law apartments, whatever you want to call them, or build like even as much as a fourplex in some places. The thing that they didn't do was require that that be affordable housing. So there are places where we may see more luxury housing, you know, luxury apartments, and I say that in air quotes, built. But again, adding to the inventory is ultimately going to lower the cost of apartments, housing in the state.
And I think this is going to be a really good year, a much better year for affordable housing in 2025. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that, if you look at some of the recent stories that are projecting Phoenix as a housing hotbed again, you know, there's, you know, more available inventory. Our vacancy rate was really, really low. It was like 2.4%.
Yeah.
And that's like historically low. That will bump up. I think there'll just be more opportunities for cities and towns to partner with the governor on affordable housing. And I just think the housing pipeline will improve dramatically. And I think, once again, the governor can lead on that by just putting a framework out there, putting a vision out there. We want, you know, people like, you know, first responders, nurses, teachers, all to be able to afford or either rent or own, you know, a place.
So, Chip, you brought up housing, and I want to ask you about one of the issues that was a pretty big issue at the Capitol and seems like it will continue to be into the new year, which is the issue of housing and water and the governor's and the ADWR's decision to basically suspend some building in some areas where there was not a 100-year assured water supply. The Water Resources Department is looking into, you know, some alternative ways to achieve that if, you know, if groundwater is not going to be the answer. Traditionally in Arizona, water has sort of been a bipartisan issue. Everyone sort of works together on this. And to some extent, it seems like the disagreement lines aren't necessarily Democrat, Republican. To some extent, it's maybe urban and rural or some more ideological. But I'm wondering, like, is there compromise? Is there agreement to be found on this issue?
I really believe there is. I think my theme for 2025 is GSD, get stuff done. You know, and I think, you know, they call it the ag to urban bill, meaning, you know, converting agricultural land to urban land to reduce, you know, reduce groundwater uses. And they were pretty close last year on a bipartisan piece of legislation. I think I'm optimistic they will get that done this year. It's so important to the future of Arizona and how we live and breathe and work. So,
and I've seen bipartisan work even while I was still there. I mean, if you remember the whole Rio Verde issue, the Wildcat development that, you know, lost their water from Scottsdale, and Collodin and Tarek worked together to get that done.
A Republican and a Democrat.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
So there is room. And you're right, the issue is more urban rural more than it is Democrat Republican.
We have 10 counties, 10 of our 15 counties right now have no law protecting groundwater. That's kind of crazy to think about.
Right.
So they have to do something to fix that imbalance.
And of course, we also have Attorney General May's lawsuit against Fondamonte with their groundwater pumping in La Paz County. So clearly this is going to be, safe to say, an issue going into 2025 and probably beyond.
Right. Yeah, I would agree. I think that, you know, we've got to get beyond this who can afford the longest straw and get back to equitable, sensible use of water.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, Attorney General Chris Mays is going to keep fighting that Saudi.
And she should.
Yeah, so it's going to be top of mind for the legislature in 2025.
Yeah.
This year's election dominated the conversation, starting long before any ballots were actually cast. And to discuss what happened, I asked Chip if he saw any overarching themes about how the races played out, either nationally or here in Arizona.
I think the thing that stood out to me, and I talked about it for years with the Biden White House because I'm in the messaging, you know, PR communications. they didn't do a good job of messaging what they were doing for the economy with the bipartisan infrastructure, the CHIPS Act. And it, this election said to me, it doesn't really matter what you say. It doesn't matter how outlandish you are, you know, whether no matter where you're on the political spectrum. If you can convince voters and scare voters that the economy is terrible and the price of eggs and gas is too high and inflation's out of control, you will win unless the other side puts up a legitimate policy argument for why things are better than they say. And I think that cut through anything. I mean, President-elect Donald Trump, you know, during a national debate where 74 million people watched, said that immigrants were eating cats and dogs.
Right.
There was moments like that where I said to myself, okay, this is going to be the tipping point. I'm saying this as a, you know, in air quotes, moderate Republican, where like everything outlandish, you know, the New York City at Madison Square Garden, that rally there, I thought, okay, this is going to. And it showed it did not matter. So the economy and the inflation, how people are feeling in their pocketbooks, just was overwhelming.
I mean, how many years ago was it that James Carville said it's the economy, stupid?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And it was economy, immigration, and then health, right? And and that also rolls in the abortion issue here in the state. And if you look at like our statewide initiatives and how they passed, I think, again, that messaging around a perception of personal safety played into, I forget the prop numbers now. It was so long ago. I mean, it was last month.
Yeah.
But the Secure Border Act and then the issue of the nuisance issue on
Prop 312.
That's it.
Dealing with homelessness. Yeah.
Yes. Those especially, I think, one, because voters feel some sense of apprehension, danger at home, and that messaging won out.
How much of that, Jen, do you think sort of filtered down from the presidential race and maybe even other national races? And how much of it was maybe what was happening here in Arizona?
Well, certainly the national messaging, I think, was really effective. I mean, you know, the incoming president was talking about, you know, the invasion at the border and, you know, every house in the nation was going to find, you know, an illegal immigrant in there eating their dogs and raping their children and, you know, we're just in a dangerous place. Talked about, you know, the danger of violent crime, even though, you know, violent crime has gone down steadily. So it wasn't the facts. It was people's perception that made the difference.
And I go back to my point of like what Jen just said, all politics is national now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the crime stats don't bear out what the Republican ticket was saying. But that narrative seeped into the public consciousness. And it became like, oh, God, we're living in really dangerous times. And, hey, there's crime, and it's, you know, it's horrible anytime anything happens. But, again, the Biden White House and the Harris campaign didn't correct him enough and point out the facts, in my humble opinion. So,
well, so do you think that this is, you know, we heard, for example, then I think he was a candidate the first time when incoming President Trump said he could sit, you know, stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and wouldn't lose any support.
Right.
There have been so many instances where he has said stuff that, Chip, you and others have said, okay, this is it. Mm-hmm. Like, he can't recover from this. And from time to time, we see other Republicans sort of try that playbook unsuccessfully. So do you see the results in 2024 as President-elect Trump kind of dragging everybody along with him? Could another Republican have done that, or could another Republican do that in 2 years?
No, he's a unique phenomenon, and I can't explain it, but like to your question, if he won't be on the ballot in 2026, so it's a whole different ballgame. You know, he brought whatever his charisma, magnetism, you know, his fear factor resonates with public, especially with rural working class voters, even with Latino men, you know, African-American men. But other Republicans just try that and they can't do it. If J.D. Vance or someone else like that tries to do that, it just doesn't work. He's a one-time candidate. You know, he's a generational candidate, whether you like him or not.
And I think that played out here in our U.S. Senate race. Yeah. Carrie Lake really, I mean, there's not much daylight in her rhetoric compared to the incoming president, and it didn't serve her well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a perfect example.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then, Jen, you know, there's been a lot of obviously hand-wringing among Democrats about, okay, what do we have to do with our messaging? We're losing this population group. We're losing this demographic group. Do you think that Democrats really need to do that much hand-wringing, or is it just a matter of they just need to run in elections that Donald Trump is not on the ballot? Like, is it just that simple?
I would say having him at the top of the ticket probably played an important role overall. Personally, I would like to see us tighten up our message around the economy, especially. That I think that could have made a difference. And I think that there's work to be done, but I'm not going to fault any particular Democrat for how they ran their race.
I was going to say, regardless of Trump, whether he's on the ballot or not on the ballot, one thing that's been readily apparent, and Democratic pollsters or consultants, when I've moderated panels, the declining numbers of Democrats in Arizona, the voter registration numbers, this year was quite shocking. But I think people thought, oh, independents and moderate Republicans will save Democrats because it's Trump. But there's been a deterioration of voter registration. Jen, you may have more insight on that, being a former Dem lawmaker. So,
well, and I think the other thing that played into this election was the protest vote from good, solid Democrats, probably much further left, and I would say much further left than I am, who offered a protest vote of either no voting certain races or voting third-party candidates over issues like Gaza. That played a lot into, I mean, because the margins are slim enough that when you peel off that 1%, 0.5%, it'll sway an election.
I was just going to say this one, if there's an example of a Democrat doing things, you know, for, she believes for the in the right and doing it for the right reasons, is it's Attorney General Chris Mayes. We mentioned the, how do you pronounce it?
Fondamente,
fighting the Saudi company who's sucking up our water.
Kroger merger.
Yeah, the Kroger merger. She's gone after big tech and other corporate landlords. She's someone, you know, you may not like her style, but she's proactive and she stands for something. So when she runs for reelection in 2026 against Senate President Warren Peterson or somebody else, people in rural, urban, you know, Arizona, whether they're Democrats or not, are going to say, that lady, I don't know her, but man, she's got some guts and she stood up for things. I think that's what the Democrats need to do more of. And, you know, I think that would help.
Mm.
So speaking of people who try to get things done and talk about getting things done, and, you know, some people don't really like their style, I want to ask each of you briefly about outgoing Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who, I don't know if it was considered a surprise by the time she announced that she wouldn't be running, that she wasn't running. But that, of course, set up the race between Ruben Gallego and Kerry Lake. Gallego, of course, won that race. Jenna, I'm curious what you make of sort of Senator Sinema's legacy at this point. I mean, she was a pretty big part of getting a lot of stuff done in the Senate. And yet her calculation was that she couldn't win again.
Yeah, true. Senator Sinema did get a lot done. Her approach to bipartisanship and deal cutting and holding out her vote served her well, and in many cases served our agenda well. There were places where I personally felt some impatience. You know, we had some opportunity to do some work on gun violence prevention, and, you know, the filibuster didn't allow us to get that done. I think now a lot of us actually— there is a personal friend who may be listening that we've had some heated arguments about these issues. And he's like, liking the filibuster now, aren't you, Longden? It's like, well, you got me. So I think it is a nuanced legacy, but no one can deny her efficacy and the things that she brought home to Arizona.
Chip, what do you think?
You know, I covered Senator Sinema back in the day when she was a young House
in the legislature.
Rep. Yeah, legislature, when she was almost unavoidable for comment. I think, you know, just echoing what Jen said, she's brilliant. She's a master legislative strategist. If you look at what Senator Romney or, you know, Senator Lankford in Oklahoma tried to get the bipartisan border security bill done, I think what her issue was is her style, not her substance. It was, she almost came across later in her term as a bit condescending and I know best and I'm going to pat you on the head. And I think that just upset a lot of people who probably wanted to vote for her or liked her. But there's no doubting that she is a mega talent, political talent. It's just, I don't know if she lost interest at the end or just felt, you know, she was ungrateful for what she did. But I think it was her style that hurt her way more than her substance.
So how is the Arizona Senate delegation different with Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego than it was with Kyrsten Sinema and Mark Kelly?
I think one thing that they will never talk about behind the scenes, but I think Senator-elect Gallego and Senator Kelly will get along much better. Mm-hmm. And they'll, you know, while Sinema and Kelly teamed up on things, I think you'll see a real partnership between Gallego and Kelly. And they'll disagree on certain issues, but they're both military veterans. Yeah. There's a lot of simpatico there, and I think they'll get a lot done for Arizona moving forward.
Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. I would say, you know, they're both combat veterans, and so there's that commonality. I think, too, it gives them in some ways a moral high ground that sometimes Democrats are accused of not having. You know, both of our senators are combat veterans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're now ready to talk about efficacy of military spending and that sort of thing in a way that maybe we haven't always been able to do.
And the nice thing about being in the Senate is you have a 6-year term.
Yeah.
So Mark Kelly is not up for re-election until Donald Trump's done in 2028.
Yeah, 4 more years.
And then Ruben Gallego won't mm-hmm. be up for re-election until Donald Trump has left the scene. So you can do a lot. You have a lot of wiggle room, and you could expend some political capital on big things without worrying about the 2-year cycle. So.
All right, so guys, as we start to wrap up, I want to ask each of you a couple of questions looking back and looking forward. And Jen, I'll start with you. Mm. Looking at sort of the totality of 2024, who to you was the most impactful political person in Arizona this past year?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. And, you know, there are a lot of folks I could name, but I'm going to go with someone that might surprise you, Steve Kaiser.
Okay, former state lawmaker.
Former state lawmaker. You know, Steve became an advocate for housing while he was serving. I think it's part of the reason that he went ahead and left. Since then, he stayed very involved, even out of session during the interim when the legislature is not in session. He's been convening meetings or been part of those meetings and helped shape some of the housing policy, and he's continuing to work on it. And I think he's a really good example of the power of an inside outsider.
Someone who knows how the process works, but isn't necessarily a part of that anymore.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. Chip, who to you is the most impactful political person this year?
I'm going to go really local because we worked with him for a long time, and I think he made a big impact on his city and his region. That's Mayor John Giles.
Yeah.
He's leaving office in January. You know, whether you agreed with him or disagreed with him, it showed a ton of political courage for him to, you know, endorse Democrats, to go against Donald Trump. But also what he did for the city of Mesa, helping revive their downtown with the ASU Film School, you know, light rail and other things. And there was a event for him the other night, and there's so many people in the audience. You don't see this at a lot of political retirements. Most people are like golf clap, you know. There was a lot of tear shed for how much impact he had made just, you know, on young people's lives, on senior citizens and others. And I think Arizona, the region, the Maricopa County region, and across the state will miss his leadership, his conviction, and just being a good guy.
All right. So for both of you, understanding that crystal balls are often cloudy, Chip, who do you think will be the most impactful political person in Arizona in 2025?
I think, you know, this is, I'm hoping for the best here, but I think, as I mentioned before, Governor Katie Hobbs has just a phenomenal opportunity to lead on water, housing, education, elections, to set herself up for 2026. But she has that bully pulpit, and I hope she uses it.
Jen, who do you think will be the most impactful person?
Chip stole my answer.
That's okay.
Really, no, I would agree. I think the governor is really well positioned to shape policy this coming year and to deal with the legislature, the new makeup of this legislature.
Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Jen Longden, Chip Scutari, thanks to both for coming in.
Thanks.
Happy holidays. Appreciate it.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.